Day afternoon. A 35-year-old man was held this morning on suspicion of intercepting voicemails. Both have been bailed. A 17-year-old boy is expected to appear in court this evening in connection with the murders of two women in Turkey. The bodies of Marion Graham and Kathy Dinsmore, both from County Down, were found in a forest last night. It's believed the teenage suspect had been in a relationship with the daughter of one of the victims. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have met the families of three young men killed during last week's riots. The couple have been visiting emergency workers and local residents caught up in the trouble in Birmingham. Chris Sims is the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police.
All of my officers that have been spoken to have had a chance to explain what they've gone through. You know, some of them were injured in the disturbances. And this comes, I think, at a point that allows us to perhaps begin to draw a line and perhaps begin to move back to normality.
And both Kevin Peterson and Ian Bell have made centuries for England in the fourth test against India. A short time ago, the hosts were 319 for two in their first innings. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
This Bank Holiday Sunday, catch the Soul Train event at Motion Bristol for the finest in soul and reggae. For further information and tickets, go to soultrain.co.uk. Bristol's favourite soul institution, the Soul Train, is back on air this Sunday on BCFM 93.2. And tune in 7pm to 9pm for the finest in soul and jazz funk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review the news this week is Shadow Treasury Minister and Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, a situation report on the Middle East. Libya is in flames, and despite no resolution at the UN, Syria gets a personal ultimatum from Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. So like Libya's Colonel Gaddafi, Syria is reported to be ripe for regime change. And President Assad, is he another bogeyman? But as we'll hear, other forces may be at work to topple his regime. Starting with Libya and Syria, we take a tour around the region to see the lie of the land and cross no man's land, also to hear what the Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad makes of it all. Plus, the estranged wife of US Marine Corps Colonel George Griggs spilt the beans about cults in the US military back in 1997. So is the triumph of evil inevitable, since the most ruthless and greedy will stop at nothing to seize power by any means? That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry, thankfully. This weekend, highs of 20, fairly wet on Saturday, dry with hazy sunshine on Sunday. Next week, highs of 20 Celsius, a mixture of sunshine and showers. And next weekend, that's the 27th and 28th of August, highs of 16 Celsius, fairly dry with sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guests now, and joining us is Shadow Treasury Minister and Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy. Hi Kerry, welcome to Drive Time.
Hi there.
Now Kerry, what does a Shadow Treasury Minister do?
Shadow's the Treasury Minister? As Ed Balls is the Shadow Chancellor, so is the leading Labour opposition figure when it comes to George Osborne. Throughout the government ministerial teams, you will have junior shadows. So I'm the Shadow Economic Secretary to the Treasury, which means the government minister who covers things like the duty on fuel and alcohol and tobacco, and covers the environmental stuff, covers the EU budget. It's my job to scrutinise from a Labour point of view, oppose where necessary, do quite a lot of the techie statutory instruments that come through, and lead for Labour in some of the debates that we have.
And so what's your take on your opposite number? I suppose that's George Osborne's deputy, and George Osborne himself. What's your take on him?
Well, Justin Greening is my opposite number, who's seen as an up-and-coming young politician in the Conservative ranks. They don't have. She was elected 2005 when I was, and because they don't have many, or they didn't certainly didn't have many female politicians in those days, I think she became quite high profile. She's very competent. I don't agree with her on virtually anything at all, but she's competent at her job. George Osborne. I don't think you'd call him competent when it actually comes to his analysis of economic policy and the decisions that he's made when it comes to running the economy. And we've had a very bad set of economic data just in the past week alone. We've had inflation rising to 4.4%. We've had the European growth figures, where across Europe growth is at 1.3%, which isn't very good, and it's been over the last nine months it's 1.3%, which isn't great, but when you compare it to 0.2% in the UK, it shows that the UK economy is really, really flatlining. Unemployment, very disappointing unemployment figures this week, very disappointing retail figures this week, and Osborne at some point needs to realise that he's got to ditch the ideological drive towards cuts, and this idea that you can absolutely slash spending to eliminate the deficit within one parliamentary term, which is where they're coming from. He needs to realise that that is just doing huge damage to the economy, and people now are warning about the dangers of a double dip recession, and I think, you know, some very serious people are saying that could be on the cards.
But Kerry, 2 years ago you were actually in the Treasury, not a shadow Treasury minister, so you must be wishing now you'd done more to sort out the banks and the economy when you were actually in government, in power, rather than, you know, sort of criticising from the sidelines as you have to now.
Well, the fact was, and it's amazing actually now that George Osborne is starting to blame the UK's woes on global problems, because of course, you know, when he was in opposition, he refused to accept that the reason that the government was in, well, the country was in economic difficulties was because there was a global financial problems caused by the banks. I would say that Gordon Brown took exactly the right measures to try to resolve that. Yes, we did have to have a bank bailout, which has cost us some money, but the alternative would have been, you know, to let the banks collapse would have a huge knock-on impact on the economy and on businesses. And what we were doing is trying to stimulate the economy, inject money into the economy by spending in the right areas to keep the economy afloat. And it's basic economics. I'm sure Martin will agree with me on this, that at a time when the private sector is struggling and is on the brink of recession, the worst thing to do is to cut public sector spending, because you need to have that balance. And we were doing the right things. The economic indicators were showing that we'd led the country out of recession, and now what Osborne's doing is completely turning back the clock. So if we'd continued with what Labour was doing, and taken a more steady path towards cutting the deficit and a more steady path towards ensuring that the country had safely recovered from the recession, we wouldn't be in the position we're in now.
But it sounds like you're in denial, because we're constantly told by the Lib Dems and by the Conservatives that you left the economy in a mess.
Yeah, I mean, the ridiculous thing is that Vince Cable was saying completely opposite things, you know, 2 days before he got elected. I think post the general election, until he was actually given his government job, his analysis wasn't that dissimilar to what. In fact, he was, you know, he was probably saying that we were being too hardline, and then suddenly he's become converted to the Osborne School of Economics, or he's keeping his head down and not voicing his criticisms. Yes, there was a difficult economic situation when the new government came in, but that was because of the global financial crisis, because of the problems with the banks. And as I said, we were taking the right approach to getting us out of that situation. It wasn't caused by Labour overspending, which is what they would try to say. That spending was necessary partly to reverse years of underinvestment in things like schools and hospitals, but also to keep the economy afloat, you know, to keep people in jobs in the construction sector and in the public sector. And now we're seeing almost like a snowball effect, that as the cuts are happening, they're obviously going to have an impact on businesses elsewhere. You cut public sector jobs, those people can't spend money in the private sector. It's just very, very simple common sense, I would say.
Now, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Now, Martin, it's normal now for the stock exchange to be falling up to 5 percentage points a day. Now, this is wiping billions off the value of shares in Britain.
Well, yes, that's not really a question, that's a statement.
But why? Why?
Because basically the financial sector has overextended itself massively, as Kerry was just explaining. I think if we had a Labour government pursuing the kind of policies that Kerry has outlined, we would still have difficulties, because the global motor at the heart of it all, the financial system, is basically in chaos. But of course, what the Conservative Liberal government has done has not helped matters in any way. I think they're like rabbits in the headlights now. They're basically just hoping that somehow capitalism would somehow fix itself. That was never going to be the case, and it wouldn't have been the case had any other government been in power, and there would have been a necessity to question the overall policy being pursued. And I suspect what may happen now is we will have a proper crash. We haven't had the crash yet, that was just the pre-crash. A proper crash. Nobody is going to be talking about cuts of any kind once we've had a crash, because it doesn't make any sense at all. Although all governments are now talking about austerity, which frankly is madness. There is no way out down that road. And,
happens is you just get constantly more and more bigger and bigger bailouts. I mean, admittedly,
no, you can't have bigger and bigger bailouts.
The power then goes to the banks, but everyone is then
by bailing out the banks, there was a window of opportunity to put the banks in order. That window of opportunity was not taken, either here because of the change in government, or in the United States because Obama basically was funded by Wall Street. And because of that, now we probably are going to have the full-on banking collapse. The governments have no more resources to bail the banks out, and the banks will probably collapse with all the consequences. And we won't be in Kansas anymore when it's happened, and we'll have to start talking much more seriously about fundamental things like the distribution of wealth and power in the society.
Now, on Newsnight last night, Paul Mason, who's their economics editor, was talking about there being certain actually possible magic bullets, but none of these actually being doable. They're all at the moment apparently unthinkable. So it's one of them at some point is going to have to happen. He's talking about the breakup of the euro, nationalisation, further nationalisation of the banks, or actually using our government share in the banks to force them to lend, and you know, to basically direct economic policy via that. And he was also talking about protectionism potentially being a way around this current crisis. Which of those three, or any others, do you think is likely to be the one that's going to come along next?
Well, because something's got to happen. Willy-nilly, governments will adopt whatever expedients seem to be expedient. That's what happened in the 30s, and it's likely to happen here. One of the things that we still haven't done is switch on the printing press in the European Central Bank. That may well happen. They're clearly thinking in terms of further quantitative easing in the US.
But isn't that just staving off the inevitable?
No, it's not. It's not even staving off the inevitable. It's just having another fix and hoping that you're going to cure yourself of being an addict. It's not going to sort. Fundamentally, there's a massive imbalance in the distribution of wealth and income. And the last 30, 40 years have seen that the concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer hands. And of course, with the banks having been rescued, they've now taken all that rescue money and paid it out as share options and as bonuses. That is the money we should be reinvesting in the economy. But it's all gone down the drain into the wrong direction.
A bit disastrous, Martin. If you were in George Osborne's shoes now, the Chancellor's shoes, what would you actually do to turn things around?
Well, what he should have done is pretty much what Labour was doing, and that's, I think, what the electorate voted for when they voted for a Lib Dem coalition, is they pretty much wanted Labour's policy with a change of personnel. But I think it's been interpreted by the Conservative right wing as a kind of carte blanche to come up with all their pet projects about everything, which of course it isn't. And I think if the government had adopted a rather conservative policy of pursuing pretty much the same policy as would have been pursued by a Labour government, we wouldn't necessarily be in the same panic stations we are now. But they are going to have a big shock. I think that their policy is actually... The British ship of state is now bow on to the financial wave. Beam on to the financial wave instead of bow on. We would have had problems anyway, but they have made those problems far worse than they otherwise would have been. The price of that is going to be a political crisis in Britain before Christmas, I think.
Well, that's a nice nautical analogy. But what about you, Kerry, and Ed Balls? What's your position at the moment? If you were in the driving seat in George Osborne in the Treasury, what would you be doing now to turn things around?
Well, I think the important thing to realise is that any economic approach ought to be something that you are flexible about as economic circumstances change. So when we approached the general election, our view was that we would try to halve the deficit within the parliamentary term. We thought And Ed Balls actually, during the leadership contest, expressed some doubt, saying, you know, given the way that the economy was going, perhaps even that would be, have too drastic an impact and would actually be counterproductive. So I think it's important that you look at the situation you inherit. But, you know, our view is basically, yes, you need to gradually bring down the deficit, but to do it too quickly and to do it in the draconian way that Osborne is trying to do it at the expense of absolutely everything else won't work. I mean, Osborne had to borrow 46 billion recently.
It won't even work in terms of the deficit.
Yeah,
this is the point that listeners need to get.
He's having to borrow more money.
The deficit is getting worse,
yeah.
And this is what's going to really do for the government.
We're not going to end up in a situation where we've paid off the deficit, but at the expense of having high unemployment, high inflation, and people are really, really being hit by the rising living costs at the moment. What we end up with, a deficit that's growing as well, borrowing that's growing, yeah, plus all those things that are going wrong. And it's you know, I hope that Osborne, you know, Labour calls for Osborne to adopt a plan B. I hope at some point he stops being so stubborn about this. There was a very good article in the Financial Times earlier this week by Christine Lagarde, the new head of the IMF, who is by no means on the left, but she was saying that it would be a mistake for countries to slam on the brakes too quickly, and that's exactly what we've done in the UK. We've slammed on the brakes too quickly and we're seeing the consequences.
Okay, on to our first story. And the Big Society Bank, this is actually from a couple of weeks ago, changes its name and appoints a chair and chief executive. So this is something which was promised just after the general election, that we were going to have a special bank for the Big Society. The only problem is that all the money in the Big Society Bank is in dormant bank accounts. So rather than track down the people who should have access to those dormant bank accounts, the city has handed all this money over to something called the Big Society Bank. Also, in the Third Sector Online magazine, where I found this story, they've got the board of the Big Society Capital Limited and the Big Society Trust down here. One of the committee's first investments will be about £1 million in the Private Equity Foundation, half of which will be equity in a fund that will make payment by results investments in charities supporting disadvantaged young people. The other half will support the PEF in order to attract other investors to that fund. That's the Private Equity Foundation. Now, Kerry, just give us, putting aside for a minute the ethics of whether you should be taking money from dormant accounts, which people have lost or forgotten about, and using it to help charities, this is surely is going to be a really big help to charities in the future, because many of them are suffering now right across the country with a lack of funding, with lots of the money from, for example, the lottery going to the Olympics. And anyway, the investment on the capital for many charities is now down to virtually zero because of the low interest rates. Mm. So this is great news, surely.
Well, the whole Big Society thing is a gimmick because, you know, it's basically the government trying to create the impression that there's going to be this huge upsurge of community activity and voluntary work. And, you know, the idea is great that you would get the community involved, but if you completely cut their resources, and I'm seeing organisations in Bristol, there was one that I was just being told about earlier today that's had £129,000 worth of funding just axed, which basically means the whole infrastructure, the organisation, which has done some really good work, will cease to exist. On the dormant bank accounts, actually, that was something that Labour introduced. And I was on the Treasury Select Committee when we first started looking at it. And it's not the hoops that have to be. It's something they do very successfully in Ireland and have done for years. And basically, it's not just the moment you ignore your account for a few months, someone will come in and steal all your money. They do have to jump through quite a lot of hoops to prove that they've done everything they can to trace the owner. But there's a lot of money sitting there. And it's quite small amounts usually. There were some larger sums, but usually it's small amounts where they can't trace it, but it adds up to quite a lot. So I do support the idea of using that money. I'm just not sure that all this infrastructure of setting up the, you know, Big Society Capital, as it's now called. It looks like the chair, I mean, Sir Ronald Cohen said that he wasn't prepared to be the chair, but now he's agreed to be the acting chair, which sounds like he's not wildly enthusiastic about it either. And I would have thought, you know, why do you have to have this? Why do you have to have this as a substitute for the government actually funding things? And that was, you know, the money from the dormant bank accounts was going to go into Treasury coffers and then be paid out by the government. This, to me, seems like another way of undermining the government's role in supporting the voluntary sector.
What's your thoughts on this new Big Society Bank, Martin? It does look like it's going to be a while before it's actually functioning properly.
Well, I think I agree with Kerry that it's largely a gimmick. And the other thing, of course, is that it fudges the relationship between public and private private money so that the voluntary sector becomes a kind of Trojan horse for private profiteering in government contracts and so on. The Bank of North Dakota was established in the early part of this century by popular pressure from farmers and so on, and that's actually owned by the state of North Dakota, and North Dakota is the only state in the US which is currently solvent as a result of that. And I think that these kind of non-state solutions are deliberately designed to be non-state solutions, because the only solutions actually come ultimately from the state having a clear policy. And this is a way of basically, how can one put it, it's fiddling while Rome burns. None of this is going to solve the basic problems that the economy faces.
Number two on the board of the Big Society Capital Limited is a former executive of JP Morgan. I mean, it sounds to me as if this is just a sort of offshoot of the Citi.
Well, I mean, you've also got social enterprise type people in there, and Jeff Mulgan, who used to be an advisor to Gordon Brown years ago, I believe.
Yeah.
I mean, the point is that this kind of, why don't we get the public and private sectors together? Well, that's called the private finance initiative, isn't it? And the fact is that public money should not be committed to private profitable activity, and that there should be a clear separation between them. This whole social enterprise, social economy narrative, if you like, and I used to work in this field, so I do know, I'm very well aware of it. A lot of it is a way of the government avoiding its responsibilities by saying, oh, well, this is being dealt with by these other organisations over here, and therefore the government washing its hands of what it needs to do. I'm not against voluntary sector.
And then watching whilst the voluntary sector collapses.
Well, exactly. Ultimately, the voluntary sector often delivers services for government, and the ideology behind it is that voluntary sector will take over a lot of government services and do them more sensitively and so on. But ultimately, it's also a way of getting the private sector involved in doing public things. And that basically just means profiteering. So you run an old people's home for profit, and that means that the profit has to be taken out. It's actually more expensive. The PFI, there's just been a report by Parliament, a parliamentary committee on the PFI, just saying what a waste of money it was. And of course, New Labour and Gordon Brown was very keen on PFI.
Answer that one, Kerry, yeah. Because these private finance initiatives have been used for many of our latest hospitals, schools, this kind of thing. And now, if you look at the actual figures, in fact, some of which were at the time that they were signed, were supposed to be commercially confidential, so people didn't know what the local authorities and health authorities were signing up to. What are your thoughts on the PFI? Because it's now looking like we've got a bit of a raw deal.
Well, I think if you look back at the PFI that was originally introduced by the Conservatives, there was some absolutely, it was practically handing money over to the private sector. They're making huge profits out of it, and we did try and tighten it up, and there were sort of various changes, things particularly important from the workers, for those organisations involved, that we changed the rules so that the workers wouldn't lose their terms and conditions, wouldn't lose their pensions and things. But the crucial issue about whether it's value for money, I welcome the Treasury Select Committee report, because I think it's really important to scrutinise that. If I can just briefly say about this Big Society Bank thing, though, which I don't think the PFI is particularly relevant to this, I have to say, but what I think is important, I went to the States with the Treasury Select Committee about 5 years ago, and they have these community development financial institutions, which are actually community-based, and it's where all the charities, the local organisations, voluntary sector, will do their banking. And I think that, and it's actually partly funded by the big private sector banks. They have a levy on them to pay for it. And I think that perhaps doing something like that, perhaps using the credit unions as a model, allowing them to, at the moment they can't lend to organisations, only individuals, I think that would be much better, doing it at that community level rather than having this big organisation called the Big Society Bank.
But going back to your work in the Treasury, Shadow Treasury team, ultimately, how are we going to actually force our banks and our money supply to actually deliver what people need? This is the ultimate question, and really this isn't what Labour didn't actually deal with this whilst in power. They didn't actually take control of the banks. The banks are still, these private banks, even though some of them have been effectively nationalised, are still one step removed from government control.
Yeah. Well, you had the Merlin report, which was all about encouraging banks to lend more to companies, because there's a real issue about companies not being able to access finance at the moment.
Yes, but they can't force them to.
Yeah, and well, that is the problem with the Merlin report. It's got no teeth at all, and I think more ought to be done to sort of ensure that it does have force. With the what I was saying about lending to funding these community development financial institutions, a bit of a mouthful, but there's actually something in the States called the Community Reinvestment Act, and basically if the banks then aren't lending to people in the poor, they actually look at postcodes and areas of the thing. If they're not lending to businesses and people in those poor areas, if they don't want to do business on the unprofitable side, there will be a levy, there will be money taken away from them and given to institutions that will. And
I think
that's something that I've been calling for a long time.
Isn't it better simply to use the government shareholding to actually sack directors when they don't deliver?
Well, I think that many people are unhappy with the fact that we've actually bailed out the banks. We've now in a position where we've got control over some of the institutions, and yet they're still carrying on operating as they did when they were in the private sector. And that's something that we've certainly been challenging the government about. People feel a real sense of resentment, I think, that they, they feel that, and you saw it actually with the riots on the streets the other day. I think some people did put it forward as a bit of an excuse, but there was, I think, a genuine sense of resentment that, we've bailed out the banks, the bankers are still doing absolutely fine, they're not paying the price for anything, we're the ones paying the price, and we're seeing it every day when we go to the shops and when we try to fill up the car or whatever, we're paying the price for the mess that they got us into.
Okay, we'll be talking about the riots from last week in a little while, but now Marina Morris is here with some information about unemployment.
The unemployment statistics. Nationally, according to the new figure from the Office for National Statistics, unemployment for the 3 months to June 2011 is up by the more than 37,000 to almost 2.5 million people, or 7.9% of people of working age. 70.7% of people were in work, with the remainder being described as economically inactive. The total number of people in work continues to increase, indicating the available workforce is growing faster than new jobs are being created. Locally, according to NomisWeb, a website providing a regional analysis, all based last up to the date, this data for the year to December 2010. 7% of workforce in the catchment area of Bristol City Council were unemployed. Compare this a 6% average for the Southwest region and 7.7% national average. Examining this data set over recent years, Bristol's unemployment is higher than the average for the Southwest region, but lower than the national average, and seems largely following national trends. Nationally, youth unemployment measure as a number of people aged between 16 and 24 years old continues to grow, this in unemployment rate up from 20% in the previous quarter to 20.2%. This is the second highest statistic this century, just less than the record of 20.5% recorded in the final quarter of 2010. The average figures recorded this century, however, is 14.5% and the lowest 11.7% recorded in 2001. Levels have been increasing steadily since then, and there have been always about this average since 2008. It appears as a new norm of 20%, or one in five of our young people is establishing itself. But this increasing trend will things get worse. Compound this issue, this graduate unemployment, removal of the education maintain allowance, increased tuition fees, and one reason for this furious backlash seen on the nation's street from the country's youth becomes apparent. You are almost three times as likely to be unemployed as the average worker if you are in your young adult and your choices and chances in life limited.
Well, this is pretty scary stuff, Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP. What's your take on this? This is the second highest statistic we've had for unemployment this century. Another thing I'd note is that women continue to bear the brunt of layoffs, many of which are concentrated in the public sector. The 38,000 increase in unemployment over the quarter, 21,000 were women.
Well, that's certainly the impact of the government's economic measures on women was something that we'd been highlighting ever since they got in and introduced their first emergency budget, or so-called emergency budget. And I think, it's obviously unemployment, whoever it affects, is is not a good thing. But I think particularly when you've got young people, I think we're seeing a return now to the sort of mood that I saw when I was growing up in the 1980s. And I was the only one in my circle of friends that actually went down the academic route and went on to university. The others were unemployed for the best part of the 1980s, you know, for sort of 7 or 8 years. And occasionally they'd be put on some job creation scheme for 6 months doing work that didn't really equip them to do anything else. And then they'd go back to being unemployed. And they genuinely thought that they would never ever find work. They thought that they were concerned. They didn't come from workless families. And then people talk now about generations of unemployment being passed, sort of it being passed on from generation to generation. But these are people, that, and there's a, it fosters a real sense of despair and hopelessness, and that it's very difficult to, they think they're not going to be able to salvage their lives once they get into their 20s, and they can't see themselves ever being able to have families houses.
Isn't this really inevitable? It's just a result of deindustrialisation. China's building everything now, and we're not anymore, so we're bound to have, you know, this kind of, you know, high percentage, 20.5% now of unemployed.
Well, it depends whether you accept that most people can only do unskilled jobs, because that's what's happened. It's mostly the unskilled jobs that have gone to overseas, and I think that more could be done to protect what manufacturing we have in this country. But the success stories in manufacturing in this country are the high-tech, high-skilled things. You know, I regularly go and visit places like Rolls-Royce and BAE, and a lot of we've got the new National Composite Centre up at Emerson's Green at the Science Park, which is absolutely fascinating.
Okay,
the work they're doing.
What is the National Composite Centre?
Composites is about bringing different materials together, like fiberglass and things. So it makes things like aircraft wings. I think it does things like Formula One cars, but it can also do loads and loads of tiny little things. And it's the National Centre of Excellence across the country.
But this
and
is
all
a trend.
All the scientists will be, and the creative people within companies will be bringing their ideas to the centre to develop it. So it's real cutting edge, and it's something that we're a world leader in.
But it's a bit like the global economy. This unemployment increasing gradually, it's a slow trend. Yeah. And when Labour was in power, unemployment was creeping up at the same sort of rate. The other thing to add to all this in the mix is immigration and immigrants coming in who are prepared to work for much less than traditional amounts of money that have been paid. Mm. I mean, this is one of the things that's often happened during privatisation. When something's privatised, the new organisation will actually lower payer conditions and even sometimes directly advertise in other countries to try and get people into the country to do those jobs cheaper.
Well, we certainly saw that. I mean, with First Bus went out to Poland to recruit bus drivers, as I understand it. Labour has said that they underestimated the impact of Eastern European immigration on job figures now. But I think it's a broader issue than that, and I think it's very easy to just use that as an excuse for what's happened. I do think that the way that the economy is moving, as I said, away from the unskilled, the sort of heavy industries that we used to have, does mean that we need to put far more emphasis on education and training so that people can do the more highly skilled jobs. And there's a danger that people that leave school without qualifications will find that they don't have those sort of manual jobs that they used to be able to rely on in the past, and they will either end up as, you know, sort of very poorly paid service sector jobs, call centres, you know, cleaning jobs, that sort of thing, which is a very insecure apart from anything else. Just be unemployed.
So have we completely given up now? Has the Labour Party now given up on full employment?
No, well, that's why we have got this emphasis, and we think it's so important, to have things like, say, the education maintenance allowance, which was encouraging children from poorer backgrounds to stay on in sixth form, which the government has scrapped, and that was entirely aimed at addressing this sort of problem. The whole thing about university, you know, our aspiration to get us somewhere near the rest of Europe in terms of the percentage of children that went on to higher education, which we're, you know, lagging way behind. And again, the government has introduced tuition fees, which are going to do nothing at all to encourage. But, you know, why would you spend £30,000 getting yourself through university if you don't think you're going to get a job at the end of it? I would say that, we do think it's an incredibly important issue. We also think that the government has got a role in fostering economic, you know, investment and the development of things like a National Composite Centre, which was supported with government money. What the new government is doing is things like these enterprise zones, which they made an additional announcement about some new enterprise zones the day the unemployment figures came out, as though, you know, this is going to be the magic one that solves it. If you actually look at what the enterprise zones are all about, they're going to not even create the same number of jobs that were lost this month. You know, they're just another, as with the big society bank, it's just another gimmick, another fig leaf.
Largely about relaxing planning controls and things like that. Martin, what's your take on this? Because I'm a bit concerned that our governments of any colour, yellow, red or blue, have all given up on full employment, the idea that everyone can be employed. What can we do?
Well, I mean, there obviously, if you pursue the right macroeconomic policies, you avoid getting into a worse mess than the one you're already in. And that's the first point to make. Don't do anything stupid, like try and cut public expenditure, as the government's trying to do. I think in the longer term, or the medium term, we're actually a far wealthier society than we were in the 1950s and 1960s when we had full employment. But don't forget, we redistributed wealth and income from the top to the bottom, and it was regarded as absolutely normal function of the government to do that. We've got to get that sense back that everybody has rights and responsibilities in society. I mean, the Prince Charles and various others have been talking, even the Daily Express were talking about a national service or whatever. Now, I don't believe in compulsory national service, but the idea that every child should be given, or every young person should be given something useful to do with their late teenage, early 20s, is not necessarily a stupid idea.
Is it a good idea to get the hoodies and train them to use guns?
No, I'm not talking about national service, military national service, and nor was Prince Charles. He was talking about some kind of something being provided for people. We're not just, if we're going to pay people to be on benefits, we might as well pay them to do something constructive. And we actually need to rethink, what do we want to do as a society? And then we've got to cost it out, and then we've got to find the resources to do those things we need to do. But we won't do that while we're relying upon the magic of the market to do it for us. That somehow the market has to be the solution. The market isn't the solution. It never was the solution. And I think that if we go into a major crisis, I think we are going to, I hope that the Labour front bench will be flexible enough to think more radically about what may be required. I won't put it any stronger than that.
Now, as I said, we're going to talk about the rioting now, and we'll hear in a moment what you think, whether you think some of these unemployment figures are anything to do with it. I had two clips of Theresa May speaking on Monday, one which is about 3 or 4 minutes long, but eventually I chose one which is only about a minute, and this is the Home Secretary Theresa May speaking on Monday, and basically giving her announcement about police budget cuts still going ahead despite the riots.
So when Labour says stop the police cuts, I say stop jumping on bandwagons. They claim they want a moratorium on police cuts, but their spending plans would cut the police by 12%. They claim they can guarantee police officer numbers, but just earlier this year they said they couldn't. They claim they oppose front-loaded cuts, but that's exactly what their spending plans imply. They oppose the Windsor Review and Police and Crime Commissioners, but we know these are things they planned to do when they were in office. I'm not saying that police budgets in this spending period aren't challenging, but they are achievable. So we are working with the police to find savings and efficiencies that eventually could save more than the total spending reductions we're asking the police to make. For example, we know from HMIC's work that if the least efficient forces brought themselves up to the average level of efficiency, we could save £1.15 billion per year. And we know that if all forces caught up with the most efficient forces, we could save a further £350 million.
That was the Home Secretary, Theresa May, speaking earlier this week and making it very clear that despite the rioting last week, there will be no slowdown in the cuts to the police budgets. And she was saying there, Kerry, that the Labour was going to announce to do the same, although apparently you've been changing your mind one way or another. So why was that? Are you saying the same, that the Labour Party is also going to cut the police?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't possibly claim to understand where Theresa May gets her figures from, but I mean, certainly we're opposing these cuts to the police. That when the government announced the cuts, they said there would be no cuts at all to frontline services, and that's been proved wrong. I met when Ed Miliband was in town on Tuesday. We had a private meeting with some senior police officers that were saying we're losing about 100 frontline posts a year, I think the figure was, and a couple of hundred if you look at the overall jobs. And I think also that distinction between frontline policing and back office is a bit of a false one, because if you haven't got the back office staff to provide the administrative support to police, you end up with the police having to do all the admin work themselves.
Well, what's she saying? She's instead of going out on the streets. She's going to cut that red tape to allow more police out on the streets. So she can cut the budget without actually changing the whole sort of frontline service.
Well, the analysis is that there were 16,000 police jobs will go, and certainly, you know, when I speak to senior police officers, and you've got chief constables from across the country that are telling her that it will have a real impact on frontline policing. And I think you do have to look at what the additional demands on policing will be over the coming year. I mean, we've had a lot of unrest on the streets, and I think one of the problems, you know, it's been suggested that one of the reasons why Manchester kicked off in the way that it did was because Manchester police had gone down to London to help them police things. And David Cameron kept using this phrase when we had the emergency recall of Parliament last week about being able, I think it was about a surge or something. It was the word was about bringing in police officers from other forces to police areas when there were signs of unrest. But as we know, I mean, you look back at the 1981 riots, you look at even what happened in the last couple of weeks, there tends to be copycat riots, and a spark that's lit somewhere will end up lighting a spark further down the road. So I think it's very dangerous to always assume that police officers can be brought in from elsewhere. You ought to have a police force that's capable of policing your own streets. And as we get towards things like the Olympics, that will need a huge police presence for security reasons. And I just think it's very, you know, certainly the chair of Avon and Somerset Police Authority wrote to me the other day saying, at least in the run-up to the Olympics, sort of try to maintain the current policing presence, and also don't go down this ridiculous path of having elected police commissioners, which I think could cost about £100 million in terms of running the elections. And it's not something that I think there's any great public appetite for, and you run the risk that you could just end up with someone that takes a very populist line on policing instead of doing what is really needed.
So what makes you say that? Because this would be a big change in the way the police are overseen by public representatives, couldn't it? So yeah. why are you so against this idea? It's a much simpler, surely, to have one elected police commissioner rather than this big committee that meets up in the tower up on the hills over in Portishead. Mm-hmm. But nobody ever, even though the public can go along to these meetings, we don't even know they're taking place.
I think that the police authority needs to have a higher profile, and people need to be more aware of what it does and the fact that it has this role. So, yeah, because there is a democratic deficit if you're not aware of it. But I think the danger, yeah, particularly in an area as diverse as Avon and Somerset, where you could end up with somebody that Bristol is very different to the rest of that area. You know, it's got the inner city areas, and I think there's a danger you could have somebody that is predominantly elected by people from the rural areas who are more likely to turn out and vote. And then when it comes to them, if the whole thing becomes politicised, are they going to be putting police resources into dealing with drug dealing on the streets of Easton or St Paul's, or are they going to be more worried about the lower level crimes out in Somerset? And I just think there's a real danger that they could be pandering to, but sometimes doing the populist thing isn't the same thing as doing the right thing.
Well, I suppose at least with the police authority we've got now, we've got a whole spectrum of opinion
exactly.
on that authority.
Exactly.
Martin, what's your thoughts about the rioting and what we heard there from Theresa May, particularly talking about things like freezing police
pay? Let's just come back to the first point we were making when we were discussing economics. It's not a sensible policy to cut at this moment at all, anyway. Mm. I would argue that in actual fact, cuts of any kind are not very sensible, although of course if Labour were in power they'd have to have a strategy for reducing the deficit, which would have to be geared around growth rather than cutting. Yeah. So first of all, the first point to make is we don't need to cut. It's actually counterproductive. Secondly, if you are going to cut benefits and opportunities for young people, you better increase the police force. I mean, in the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher gave them a massive pay increase, and she knew very well that she was going to need them, and she did need them. I think politically, it's very unwise for the Conservative government to have picked a fight with the police at this moment. It's not done them any good. Most people actually think that, I mean, personally, I think the police handled it as best they could in the circumstances. They didn't escalate things. They managed things under, and they got it under control. And of course, many police officers were dragged back from their holidays to go and have bricks and bottles thrown at them, and they didn't get any compensation for that. Whereas the politicians who flew back from their foreign holidays got all of their expenses paid. Just another example of one rule for the officers and another rule for the soldiers. I mean, basically, the police, especially in a situation like this where the economy is in a very weak state and you've got lots of young people with no chances and opportunities, you probably need more police so that they can do more sensitive policing, build the relationships necessary to keep the peace. And I think that, you know, quite clearly it's just a wrong policy, like many of the other policies being pursued.
Well, Marina Morris has been out on the streets to find out what you made of last week's rioting.
Are the rioters criminals or victims of inequality, poor parenting, bad education and other social deprivations?
On the whole, criminals, I'm afraid. They haven't necessarily got a particular grievance to bear. It was just jumping on the back of other people's grievances and then looting.
I think it all comes down to the criminals. We've all got things which we were different, or we all got things which we could change. We don't all go out smashing stuff up and breaking rules.
The signature of them probably was criminals, but a lot of them was just victims of their society and where they grew up, and they made cuts in the area. Black man got shot for no reason by the police. They say he had a gun. He never had a gun. That was proven out as a fact. So obviously black people was upset. He was going to riot. It's the right thing to do. I would have rioted myself if I was there, because they killed innocent black man. He never had a gun. That was proven.
I would say it's a bit of a mixture of them all. Certainly to do with parenting. I think the parents should control their children more, and also to give them a bit better education and help them get jobs.
I'm from Germany, from Bonn. I know they're unlucky and so on, but I can't understand them doing the riots against private people. Like, if they would go to the banks and to the council buildings, it would still be criminal, but I could understand them. But I can't understand them going to the private houses and so on.
I think it's a combination of things, really.
I think there is a lot of inequality, but there always have been riots at certain times in the past, and we haven't got to the bottom of them then. Perhaps it is time we got to the bottom of it now.
Should we jail rioters or look for other forms of rehabilitation? And will jail point them in the right moral direction or just dehumanize them?
Other forms of rehabilitation, jail isn't necessarily going to work.
I think for jail, what they did was extremely wrong. There was no point to what they did. They didn't target government, they targeted normal people. And those are the people that are left without homes or without businesses or were scared. So jail would make a point that, you know, we don't accept this kind of actions in our communities.
I don't think jail is going to have any effect on any rioters, because they're only getting a small sentence and they shouldn't be sent to jail anyway. And it's all about making a situation better where they live and grow up. And people are going to riot for different reasons. Every types of people, whatever background you come from, riot for different reasons. So it's poor areas, this riot's been going on for years anyway, isn't it?
I think the rioters should actually go to the army. They should be forced to join the army. That way, that would teach them all a lesson, and I think it's better than going to jail.
Well, maybe jail isn't the best answer, but like putting them in costs and so on, so talk about so they understand it's not right to do the riots. There are other ways of like peaceful protest.
I would want to know the background of each individual. That can't come to fruition in a magistrate's court quickly. There are a lot of people who are going to be condemned a bit inhumanely. On the other hand, there are going to be people who are going to do it again without a conscience. So it's too difficult to lump them all together and say we'll do this with them and that with them. We have to understand people a lot better than we do at the moment, and little children in particular. Look at them when they're young, and their personalities then, and not turn a blind eye to problems.
That was Marina Morris out on the streets this week, asking you what you think about the rioting the week before and the jail terms and that kind of thing. Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP for Bristol East. Why now? Why do you think the rioting has been taking place just at the moment?
Well, we've seen almost a year of unrest. We've seen unrest associated with the student protest, first against tuition fees and then against the younger students protesting about the scrapping of education maintenance allowance. We had some unrest when you had the march against the cuts on March 26th. We, of course, had particular problems in Bristol back in April, the so-called Tesco's riots. So I think people were expecting something to happen, just not knowing particularly what shape or form, whether it would happen that weekend. And it seems clear that it was the shooting of the young man in Tottenham that triggered it. And then what I think is you had the best analysis I've seen of it, actually, have been saying, and some people, you know, ranging from a 16-year-old from St Paul's to Dennis Finchcombe, who runs the Riverside Youth Project and's got an MBE for his work there, when they met with Ed Miliband the other day, they were saying that it's partly about boredom and wanting a bit of a buzz. And if you've got that sense where you haven't really got any hope or aspiration for the future, it's the most exciting thing that's happened to you for ages. If people say, oh, it's all kicking off downtown, we're going to go and join in. There was a criminal element, there were organised gangs involved. But if you look at the demographic of people who've been sentenced, it really does cover a very broad range. I think there's been a bit of an unfair emphasis on the youth of the people involved. I think something like 21% of those that have been charged with anything are under the age of 18, which means that nearly 80% weren't. But I think, you know, some people obviously were there just because they thought it was a chance to get some free items from the shops. Some were there because they were pretty thuggish or they were drunk or whatever, but I think there were some young people that just went along to see what was happening and ended up getting caught up in it.
Okay, so what about the wisdom of sending people to jail for quite draconian, really, what some would say, longer sentences than normal?
Yeah.
And you were saying whilst we were listening to that about the fact that there's very little use of these pre-sentencing reports.
Yeah. Quick plug, I've got a blog which can either be reached through my website, but it's called Shot by Both Sides, and I've been blogging about this over the last few days, and I think for a while it felt like I was the only MP that was prepared to say that the sentences were wrong. And you look at the mother of a one-year-old and a five-year-old who wasn't involved in the riot, slept through it, but her housemate looted some goods, came back the next day, and the mother said, you know, eventually said, I'm going to have one of this pair of shorts. She was given a five-month sentence. So she was basically hauled up before the courts straight away. I think she actually confessed to it. So she, hauled up before the courts, banged up for 5 months. That's a one-year-old and a five-year-old that are left without their mother, not father on the scene. She's went to a court of appeal today and was given 75 hours voluntary service, which the judge said that the original sentence was completely inappropriate. She didn't have a criminal record at all.
The whole point
of
this, though,
and I think we're going to see a lot more of those cases succeeding on appeal.
The whole point of this, though, the judges would argue, is that we need to send a very clear signal to the rioters.
Yeah, but I think they're sending a signal, saying people that, yeah, if you do this, you're going to get, you're running a high risk. But then I think there is also taking that to extreme lengths. I mean, there's also been the guy jailed for 6 months for the £3.50 worth of water. I think somebody got 6 months for chewing gum. And as I said, you know, they're not looking at... the normal process would be, if you were going to convict somebody and give them a custodial sentence, you would order a pre-sentencing report to look at what the best method of disposal was. And I actually think, from the community's point of view, if you were to see people out there who'd been involved in the rioting and looting, out there on the streets in the orange jumpsuits, doing community service, you know, I think that would send as big a signal as it would locking people away for 6 months and absolutely wrecking their lives. And also, you know, it's the kids that worry me the most, you know, because if to have your mother whisked away from you overnight is obviously not, the courts don't seem to be taking into account at all what is going to happen to these children, who's going to be looking after them.
OK, Martin, what's your view on what we heard, the Vox Pops there, particularly on the topic of jail? I mean, for some people, maybe jail is actually going to be an education in crime.
You've got to distinguish, frankly, between violence to persons and theft of property. Theft is against the law, and but people shoplift and they get caught, they get cautioned, and then they get, you know, eventually there's an escalation of punishment. But somebody stealing shorts and water is not the same as somebody runs somebody over in a car and kills them. The community wants to see people who carry out serious violence against others dealt with in a firm fashion, and nobody's denying that should happen. But let's not, there's also a knee-jerk reaction from the comfortable suburbs here, which from many magistrates are drawn from, and they're basically they're not sticking by their own guidelines. You shouldn't be sending people to prison for stealing a first offence of stealing water. You really shouldn't. It's just silly. And of course, on appeal, a lot of these things are going to be overturned. Basically, you should get it right the first time.
Okay, on to our next story. And UK banks have been funding a deadly cluster bomb industry. This is the little campaign, in a way, that's been run by The Independent. Excellent campaign, in my view, this week, pointing out that British banks, including Royal Bank of Scotland, which is owned by the public, apparently, has been funding cluster bombs. Martin, do you want to just explain what a cluster bomb is and why it should matter?
Well, I'm no particular expert, but a cluster bomb, basically, it's got lots of little bomblets in it, and it's particularly vicious because these little bomblets hang around, and then children and other people, farmers, lose limbs and life. So it renders whole areas, like southern Lebanon was bombed with cluster bombs in 2006 by the Israeli Air Force, and large areas of southern Lebanon are uninhabitable as a result. So they're nasty weapons.
A little bit hypocritical for them to be doing this whilst they're actually getting very close now for an international agreement to actually completely ban these cluster bombs. The British insurer Aviva has created a stop list of 12 arms manufacturers, which includes the US defence giant Lockheed Martin, Textron and Alliance Tech Systems. All three companies have received hundreds of millions of pounds in investment from British high street banks. Although cluster bombs have been banned by Britain, Barclays, HSBC and the state-owned Royal Bank of Scotland have been able to exploit a loophole which allows them to continue investing in cluster munition manufacturers as long as they don't invest directly in the bombs themselves. Kerry, what are your thoughts about this? Because this shouldn't be going on, but it is, and actually it's been going on with a bank that we own.
Yeah, well, Labour actually introduced the ban on cluster bombs, which followed on from the earlier ban on landmines. Yeah, people were arguing, quite rightly, that it was the same sort of thing. And I went out to south of Lebanon after the bombing and sort of went out there and met the Mines Action Group that were trying to protect the land and try and clear the land of mines, and they are a hideous thing. But
because the thing about these particularly is that they're like little Coke cans, aren't they? And kids will just sort of pick them up, and then they can be completely maimed or killed just by picking up something what they think looks like a can of Coke.
Yeah, exactly. And as Martin said, there's whole areas of land that haven't yet been declared safe from the cluster bombs. So yeah, I think I agree with this. I think, you know, I mean, obviously companies like Lockheed Martin have their fingers in all sorts of pies. There's all sorts of things that the banks will be investing in without directly funding their cluster bombs activity. But it seems to me that if you've got a ban in this country on cluster bombs, if we accept that cluster bombs are a hideous weapon that shouldn't be used, we're moving towards an international cluster bomb treaty, which we're encouraging people to sign up to. The last thing that we should be supporting is a state-owned bank funding a company that indulges in such activity, even if it's, you know, not the activity that we're giving the money to fund. They need to show the same ethical priorities that the rest of the country is showing.
Okay, and Bristol is hosting the UK's largest street art project. This is from the Jack FM website. From last weekend, Bristol will be playing host to the most ambitious permanent street art project ever to take place in the UK and Europe. World's leading street artists will paint the facades of 10 multi-storey buildings along a major city centre street, that's Nelson Street, as part of a brand new event called See No Evil. Bristol's long been known for its street art movement in the UK, being a home to a host of famous artists. And now See No Evil, the biggest names in international street art, will converge on the city and take up residency on Bristol's Nelson Street. The event's a collaboration between street artist Inky, who emerged out of Bristol's 80s graffiti scene, alongside Banksy and Bristol music promoters Team Love, and is in association, I imagine that means funded by, partly anyway, Bristol City Council. Martin, have you been to have a look at this graffiti art, and what do you think about the idea of having a whole street that's been graffiti arted in the city centre?
Well, I wasn't aware of this, actually. This shows how out of touch I am. But, I mean, in principle, Bristol, of course, is a creative arts hub. And Banksy, for example, has been a great advert for the city's creative industries. So, you know, it's not necessarily a waste of money to invest a little bit of public lucre in helping this particular project. It's the kind of thing that that ought to be happening.
Kerry, not everybody likes to go down the street and see these kind of weird aliens staring out at them and multicoloured designs. Do you think the city centre really is appropriate to have graffiti all the way down?
Well, it's actually a not very attractive part of the city centre, and, you know, quite run down, neglected. A few years ago, they did a project under the railway arches at Waterloo, and it was on a bank holiday it was launched, and there were queues for like 3 or 4 hours, people going to see it. And that was some graffiti art, which eventually I got in to see. Absolutely amazing. It wasn't just people tagging their name. It was some really, really stunning pieces of work. And I think it sounds like a fun thing. I'm going to try and get to see it over the weekend. I don't think I'll be going to the all-night dance music raves or whatever it is that's going on.
What about graffiti more generally, things, though? Because some people see it as simply as criminal damage.
I mean,
if it's your wall, you don't necessarily want to have an alien painted on it.
I think, you know, this is an issue about respecting other people's property, and it's quite fun, actually, when people had Banksy doing things on their wall without permission and suddenly realise it's worth an absolute fortune. So it's done a quick U-turn on the value of graffiti. But yeah, they've got to have permission, but I think it's fun.
Okay, well, coming up now to the Sky News at 6 o'clock, thanks to this week's guest, Shadow Treasury Minister and Labour MP for Bristol East, Kerry McCarthy. After the news, a situation report on the Middle East.
Your voice and it is your choice.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.